All right. We are going to get started, gavel in, and take a informal recess. Higher Education Appropriations Subcommittee will come to order. Ms. Sherrill, please call the roll.
Chair Shove.
Here.
Vice Chair Hawkins.
Here.
Ranking Member Benjamin.
Present.
Representatives Anderson.
Here.
Baker.
Here.
Caruso. Chambliss. Excused. Cross.
Here.
Daniels.
Here.
Franklin. Garcia. Griffiths.
Yes, ma'am.
Magert.
Here.
Perez.
Present.
Rudman.
Here.
You have a quorum, Mr. Chair.
Thank you very much. Members, we will sit in an informal recess for a few minutes. All right, members, I want to thank Ms. Pridgen for weathering the storm and making it over here today. We are going to call the meeting back to order. Quorum being present, I want to welcome everybody today to the Higher Education Appropriations Subcommittee. I want to remind you all to turn off your cell phones and beepers and everything else. You know the routine on that. It's very distractive, and we don't need it in here. Today, we will hear a presentation from the Department of Education on the various student financial aid and tuition assistance programs in higher education budget. Florida has a variety of state-funded scholarships and grant programs to increase access to post-secondary education for Florida students, including need-based programs, merit-based programs, and tuition assistance and grant programs. Florida's financial aid programs assist students who may not otherwise be able to afford a college education. This provides them with the opportunity to pursue careers in technical and academic fields. It ensures that Florida students are prepared to fill the high-demand, high-wage jobs of today and of the future. Suzanne Pridgen is the Deputy Commissioner of Finance and Operations. Thank you again for being here. Ma'am, you are recognized.
Thank you. Well, that's one way to try to get out of a presentation, isn't it? It was a little bit of a surprise. Well, good morning, and thank you so much for having me here to discuss have an overview of the Department of Education's scholarship programs, which are state-sponsored some, and their grant programs as well. Most Floridians are very aware of the Bright Futures scholarship, but we have many other programs that a lot of people aren't aware of. So I will give you a brief overview of all of them, and if you would like any further information, we can dig deeper into that as well. Florida State Scholarship and Grant Programs are administered through the Florida Department of Education Office of Student Financial Assistance. The mission of OSFA is to increase access to the post-secondary education for Florida students by providing funds to students who demonstrate high academic achievement or may not otherwise be able to afford a college education. Through these scholarship and grant opportunities, our goal is to retain the top talent in Florida and provide a pathway to students to pursue careers in both technical and academic fields. State financial assistance can be broken into four basic categories: merit-based, need-based, tuition assistance, and other financial aid. Merit-based programs are awarded based on the student's high school achievement, academic achievement. Awards are given without regard to demographic or financial factors and focus solely on the student's performance in high school. Need-based programs look primarily at the ability of the student to meet all the financial requirements of attending a post-secondary institution. These awards may be available to all students or a restricted subset of students with varying factors. Additionally, the award amount may vary according to each recipient's calculated financial need. The effective effective access to student education grant program is the only tuition assistance program available. This program focuses on providing tuition assistance to students attending a private, not-for-profit, post-secondary institution. These institutions represent a cost savings to Florida taxpayers by providing an educational opportunity and not fully subsidized by the state. It's therefore in the interest of the state to look at the tuition assistance program for students that wish to attend these institutions. The other financial aid category consists of 13 programs for specific groups of students. Here you can see a graphical summary of the scholarship and grant categories and their makeup of appropriations for the 22-23 academic year. As shown in the chart, the total state appropriation in 22-23 for post-secondary student financial assistance is almost $1.1 billion. Florida has two merit-based student financial assistance programs, the Florida Bright Futures Scholarship Program and the Benequisto Scholarship. The Florida Bright Futures Scholarship, which was established in 1997, is funded by revenue from the Florida Lottery and is Florida's largest financial assistance program. This program is broken down into four distinct scholarships, the Florida Academic Scholarship, the Florida Medallion Scholarship, the Florida Gold Seal Career, and Professional Education Scholarship, which is usually referred to as the CAPE Scholarship, and the Florida Gold Seal Vocational Scholarship. The general eligibility requirements are the same for each of these awards in that a student must be a Florida resident, earn a high school diploma or its equivalent, may not have been found guilty of a felony, be enrolled for at least 6 credit hours at a Florida public or independent post-secondary institution, and apply for the scholarship by August 31st of the year that they graduate from high school. Florida Gold Seal Scholarships, both the CAPE and vocational, are geared towards students who wish to pursue a certified professional, technical, or vocational career. CAPE is short for the Career and Professional Education Act, and the CAPE scholarship is focused on providing financial assistance for students to enroll in courses that satisfy requirements and recognize CAPE professional and technical certifications. The vocational scholarship is focused on providing assistance to students who pursue an associate level degree or certification. The 2022 legislature amended the statutes governing the Florida Bright Futures Scholarship to allow 100 paid work hours to be used as an alternative to the volunteer service hour requirement. The amendment did not change the number of service hours that students are required to have for a Bright Future Award. Rather, it allowed for a student to make the determination on what is the right path for them, whether it's paid or work hours. Volunteer service or work hours. The Benequisto Scholarship is a merit-based program. It's for high school graduates who receive recognition as a National Merit Scholar. The award provides 100% scholarship for the full cost of attendance at a in-state tuition rate. This is Florida's highest publicly funded full-ride academic scholarship. This slide shows the number of students receiving Bright Future Awards and the total disbursements. This is for 12 years, so that should give you a good overview of how it's grown. Since its inception, which was back in 1997 again, we provided over 3 million awards to Florida students, totaling more than $8 billion. So this is the Bright Futures matrix. And for 2023 high school graduates, the Florida Academic Scholarships will be awarded to students who have at least a 3.5 weighted GPA, a score of 29 on the ACT or 1330 on the SAT, and who have performed either 100 volunteer service hours or 100 paid work hours. Florida Medallion Scholarships will be awarded to students who have at least a 3.0 weighted GPA, a score of 25 on the ACT or 1210 on the SAT, and who have performed 75 volunteer service hours or 100 paid work hours. The award amount for the Florida Academic Scholarship is 100% of the tuition and select fees at public post-secondary institutions. Students attending a private post-secondary institution will receive 100% of an award. That's the average of the in-state public institution and select fees. The award amount for the Florida Medallion Scholars is 75% of the tuition and select fees at public institutions, or the average of the private institutions. Students attending a private post-secondary institution will receive 75% of an award. That's the average of the in-state tuition and fees. The 2020 legislature amended the statute governing the Florida Medallion Scholarship to provide awards of 100% of the tuition and select fees at any of the Florida College System institutions in pursuit of an associate's degree program. Once the degree is achieved, the student will receive 75% of the tuition and select fees at the public post-secondary institutions. Students receiving a Bright Futures CAPE or vocational scholarship will be provided funds based on the program in which they enroll. For the need-based programs, we start off with the Florida Student Assistance Grant Program. This is the state's largest need-based program. We refer to it as FSAG. This grant program serves four sectors of Florida's education populations: public, private, post-secondary, and public post-secondary career education. The public grant is available to students attending one of the state university system or the Florida College Florida College System institutions. The private grant is provided for private, nonprofit, four-year colleges and universities. And this post-secondary grant was established to provide assistance to other private post-secondary schools not under the private grant. And finally, the public post-secondary career education grant aids students attending community college or district-operated career centers. Funding for the FSAG is provided to the Florida Department of Education from the legislature as approved in the General Appropriations Act. The amount of the award varies by sector from $200 to a maximum amount specified in the GAA. The maximum amount for the award for this current year is $3,260. This is for each participating institution. They determine the application procedures, deadlines, student eligibility, and award amounts. The Florida Work Experience Program is a need-based program providing eligible Florida students work experiences to complement and enforce their education and career goals. Each eligible and participating college, university, public community college, career center operated by a district school board, and educator preparation institute, they also determine the application procedures, the deadlines, the student eligibility, and the award amounts. Like the FSAG program, institutions participating in the Work Experience program will create and manage all of the applications, deadlines, eligibility, the same in the distribution of those awards. Each institution will hire directly or partner with a third party to employ these students. Institutions hiring directly to in-campus positions, they can recover 100% of the students' wages. Third-party employers are able to invoice the partner institution for 70% of those students' wages. This slide shows the FSAG history. In 2017-18, the appropriation was increased, and this was to provide funding for additional students that didn't originally receive the funding. It's remained at $269 million since that increase in 2017. Tuition assistance programs were created to aid students in attending independent post-secondary institutions. Awards are not based on a student's demonstrated need or specifically tied to academic performance. Eligibility and disbursements are managed by the institutions. The William Boyd IV Effective Access to Student Education Program is the only tuition assistance program administered by the Florida Department of Education. EASE provides funding to private, for-profit, and nonprofit colleges and universities. The maximum award is set at $2,000, and that's set by the General Appropriations Act for the current year. The 2021 legislature established specific reporting guidelines for institutions that receive EASE funding. Each institution must submit an annual report by September the 1st, to the department that includes the institution's most recent information on five specific metrics: the institution's access rate based on the number of Pell Grant eligible students, the institution's affordability rate based on the cost of attendance less all the financial assistance, the graduation of students completing their program within 6 years, the retention rate of students who did not graduate and return to the institution in the following year, and the institution's postgraduate employment or continuing education rate based on the number of students employed or enrolled in a postgraduate program within 120 days of their graduation. These next two slides show the results from the institution's reported performance for each of the specified metrics. While I won't go through each institution or rate, I believe it's important to the committee to be aware of the scores and how the institution is performing relative to the benchmarks. Please be aware that all the institutions do not track all the required data. We had two institutions, Johnson University and South University, who were unable to report on the employment and continuing education rate. In the future, we'll consider unreported data as having missed the required benchmark score. For this year, our recommendation was that all institutions had met the benchmark. In order to provide accountability without penalizing students, the recommended minimum metric scores were established with a five-year guide path. After the 25-26 year, the metrics will reevaluate them annually to ensure that program funds are supporting students to achieve those highest outcomes. Florida provides other post-secondary financial aid programs to varying student and professional populations as determined by specific program requirements. Over $35 million is distributed to students and professionals who qualify for the 13 programs that you see on your slide. The first one is the First Generation in College and Farm Worker. The First Generation in College grant matching program provides need-based grants to degree-seeking undergraduate Florida resident students whose parents did not complete a bachelor's degree. This program is funded by a 2-to-1 match of state funds to private institutions and is eligible for award at Florida State Universities and the Florida College System institutions. The Florida Student Scholarship, the Farm Worker Student Scholarship Program, was created in 2018. And this was to provide scholarships to Florida farm workers or children of farm workers who demonstrated academic achievement in high school. The award recipients are ranked according to unmet financial need, and awards are limited to 50 students per year. The law enforcement programs. So the Florida Law Enforcement Academy Scholarship and the Florida Law Enforcement Reimbursement Programs were created in 2022 by House Bill 3. The Academy Scholarship provides awards to fund the full cost of full attendance for a law enforcement officer, basic recruit training at a Florida College System institution or a school district technical center. The program also provides up to $1,000 to refund eligible expenses such as uniforms, textbooks, insurance, ammunition, and other consumable materials. The Florida Law Enforcement Recruitment Program was created to encourage out-of-state law enforcement officers and retired special operations military forces to obtain a Florida law enforcement certification and join the ranks of Florida's excellent police force. This program will provide a reimbursement of up to $1,000 of expenses incurred for this certification. The Honorably Discharged Graduate Assistance Program was established to aid active duty and honorably discharged veterans with living expenses incurred during holiday and semester breaks. The John R. Justice Student Loan Repayment Program is a federally funded program administered by the department, established to encourage commitment to a public defender and state prosecutor positions by providing up to $10,000 per calendar year and a total of $60,000 of student loan repayment. The Jose Marti Scholarship Challenge Grant Program provides assistance to Hispanic American students to reward their academic achievement in high school. This program is funded by a 1-to-1 match of public funds for each $5,000 of private funds, and the awards are for a maximum of $2,000 per academic year. The Mary McLeod Bethune Scholarship Program was established to provide up to $3,000 for an academic year to students attending one of Florida's historically black colleges and universities, Bethune-Cookman University, Edward Waters College, Florida A&M University, or Florida Memorial University. Eligible students must meet specific academic requirements and demonstrate financial need. The program is funded by a 1-to-1 match of public funds for each of the $2,000 private funds. The Minority Teacher Education Program encourages minority students to pursue teaching careers by providing an award of up to $4,000 for up to 3 years. These recipients are required to teach in Florida public school after graduation for 1 year for each year that they receive the award. The Nursing Student Loan Forgiveness Program provides loan repayment of up to $4,000 per year for a maximum of 4 years to eligible applicants employed at specific health care facilities throughout the state. The Randolph-Bracey ACOE Scholarship Program was created in 2021 to recognize the impacts of the Election Day riots of 1920 in ACOE, Florida. The scholarship provides up to 50 awards to descendants of victims that day or are current African-American residents of ACOE. The maximum award is $6,100 per academic year. The Rosewood Family Scholarship Program was created to acknowledge the impacts of the Rosewood Massacre of 1923. This program provides awards to descendants of the victims of that day with a maximum award amount of also $6,100 and a total of 50 awards for each calendar year, academic year. The Scholarships for Children and Spouses of Deceased or Disabled Veterans is Florida's longest continuous scholarship program. It's created in 1941, and this program provides scholarships to children and unmarried spouses of Florida veterans who died or were 100% disabled as a result of active duty service. Last year, Florida provided over $1 billion in scholarship grant and loan repayment programs to more than 280,000 students and professionals. Over the years, programs have been created, others have been eliminated, program requirements have changed, they've shifted, enrollment has fluctuated. Each year, our great state has continued to make this investment in our students and in our future. The Pell Grant is actually a federal grant administered by the U.S. Department of Education, and consideration for the grant is done through the Free Application for Federal Student Aid. The Pell Grant is a need-based program with a maximum award of $6,345 for 2020-21. Funding is sent directly to the post-secondary institution, which then distributes the funds as necessary to the students by either applying the funds to the students' open tuition and fee balances or issuing vouchers for the students to use at a campus-run bookstore. Or they can also send the check directly to the student. Because this is a federal program run by the U.S. Department of Education, the institutions do not work with us at the Florida Department of Education for these grants. However, I'm mentioning the Pell Grant since some of Florida's need-based scholarships and grants do require that they apply for the Pell Grant to qualify for the Florida scholarship. The Florida scholarships and grants also reduce the maximum eligible award by the amount the student receives from the Pell Grant. Additional information on all of these programs, as well as the Student Financial Assistance Annual Report, can be found on the OSFA website, and that is a great report. It tells you everything and anything that you ever wanted to know back through the years about the financial aid at the Department of Education. It is a super resource, and I'm sure Kira has it, and she'd be happy to share it with you as well, but thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Pridgen. That's an awful lot of information, a lot of important items. And members, I hope you all review this information. We're going to have an opportunity to ask some questions. But I can't overemphasize the importance of what she just covered and the role it plays on educating our future leaders and our children and the opportunities it gives them to get a higher education. So with that, I have a few questions, if you don't mind.
Okay.
How many total financial aid programs are there?
We have, let's see. There's 18. Around 18.
18. Very good. Do you think that parents and students have a difficult time navigating all of the options and And if so, is there perhaps in the future a recommendation that DOE could give this committee on a way to streamline that to make sure students see all of these options?
So most of the students see them first with their high school guidance counselors, or their parents may be really on top of it and know even before ninth grade that you better get this Bright Future Scholarship, FMS, FAS. But a lot of parents aren't aware, and that's what the high school counselors are there for. Now, we do have a dedicated person at the department that goes out to a lot of events, financial aid nights, college fairs, university job fairs. We're bringing in students in any kind of way. I think we can always do better. I mean, we certainly could always do better at getting out there and supplying more information. And we do a lot, just as the high school counselors do as much as they can. But it is a lot of information. And also, when you apply for the programs at the department, our application looks at other eligible programs as well. So they would be notified that you may be eligible for these programs. So when they contact us or we push information out, that's one way that they would know too, because certainly before I really got into financial aid, I wouldn't have known that we had that many options to be even aware of. And some are specifically targeted, you know, to different groups, but there's still a lot of programs for students and professionals in our state.
Thank you. Thank you. I tell you, I would love to see one day it condensed to a one-page form with all of the list and then, you know, pages behind it to explain each one, but something that allows students and their parents to see that there's this many and we, you know, qualify for this and not this. It's a difficult time in life when you're graduating high school and trying to move forward, and this is very important. So if you could we please pull up page 14 on the chart? This is going to be the EASE benchmarks.
Okay.
I have a few questions on this.
All right.
Can you explain for us the methodology used for these benchmarks and how you arrived at these numbers?
Sure. So it's been a couple of years now. And so we went out to the institutions and asked for the information initially. And we went out to them a couple of times to make sure that we were clear as to what we were asking, because this would have been that first time that we went out to them to ask for directly this information. So in calculating a lot of those, we wanted to be fair that they needed some time to ramp up. And that's what you see also, as you can see, it's around 20% increase for each year. And then after 25, 26, then we reevaluate those rates. But we took, I believe it was an average, and started from there. Definitely a work in progress at that point.
Thank you. And I just want to make sure I'm understanding this. I'm a gas guy from Port St. Joe, and looking over all of this, it appears that this recommendation is saying that 5 years from now, if we were to adopt this, that you're hoping that half the students graduate in 6 years, and of that half, only half of those find a job. Is that accurate, or am I off base?
No, that's accurate. That is. So we had to start somewhere, and we had to start somewhere. So we always do have the option of reevaluating, and it was also new data to us, new data for us to work through. We certainly have all kinds of ways to research data at the department, but not that this was a new program, but it was a new way of collecting the data. So again, we had to start somewhere, and we certainly hope and know that the institutions are striving not just to meet the benchmark, but to exceed benchmarks.
Thank you. And if you don't mind, I wanted to ask if there was anyone from ICUF in the audience today that would like to say anything on these benchmarks? Or no? Do you, and I don't mean to put you on the spot, but would you like to comment on whether ICUF supports this? And if you would, I'd ask you to come up and... Okay, then you're... Okay, I understand. Thank you. We would love to have your feedback on this. Thank you, ma'am. Thank you. So the last thing I'll say, members, and it's not really a question, I just wanted to make you all see what I'm seeing here, and make sure you do. I want to ask you all to consider that should the state be comfortable subsidizing this level of performance? It's not a, you know, it's not necessarily a yes and no question. It's just something that I'm asking you all to think about and contemplate, and maybe one day in the future we can talk about it a little bit more. So members, with that, I'm going to open it up for questions. Yes, absolutely. You're recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I do have some questions with regards to the affordability rate. Can you kind of explain that to me? I see different numbers, you know, just a kid from SysTrunk. I just want to know, what does it mean by affordability? Why are there different numbers? What
is that about? So how we calculated the affordability rate, and this is the real calculation, it was calculated by dividing the total annual federal, state, and institutional aid less the total annual tuition and fees by total number of Florida resident, first time in college, undergraduate students. And the numbers, and I don't know if, I'm sure you all received the report, it was rather all over the place. And two, I think the institutions are working on collecting these numbers too to make sure that they're reporting correctly, but this is how we collected, is the institution, what is their affordability rate? And so that's what we did. We took the total, every aid, federal, state, and institutional aid, less than the total annual tuition and fees by the total number of first time in college, Florida resident, undergraduate students.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, you're recognized.
And so if a university or college is reporting a negative number, is that to say that they, by that number, that's how far under affordability they are?
I'm going to look at Parker.
Would you please come up to the microphone and please state your name?
And this is Parker Campbell. He's the director of the Office of Student Financial Assistance at the department.
Parker, thank you. And if you could, when you're done, please fill out a speaker form.
We'll do. So there are some institutions, in some situations, where private aid can overfund a student, and you know we're only looking at, in this metric, tuition and fees. So if an institution wants to provide a scholarship for housing, that's included in that lesser amount. So we're taking away from the tuition and fees. And so there's a situation where a student could appear to be getting paid more, and that's a negative affordability rate, where they're actually getting money back above what their tuition and fees are.
And that's a bad thing?
That's a good thing. From the student's perspective. That's
right.
That's the student receiving, say, $2,000 more than what their tuition and fees cost.
You're recognized for a series if you want.
Thank you, Chair. I wanted to know, why is the award amount for need-based scholarships so much lower than the award amounts for merit-based scholarships?
So most of the need-based is appropriated. It tells us what the award would be. So we don't determine that. It's actually appropriated that way.
So that's us. Okay.
Yes.
thank you. Yeah. with regards to the scholarships for minority teachers, and considering the teacher shortage that we have, I see that amount is kind of low, considering that we have a teacher shortage. Is that also us? Is that number low because that's also appropriated? That's our fault too?
No, and it's never your fault.
Good answer.
We administer the program, how it tells us to administer it. But, yes, I believe that one is appropriated as well.
Okay. So whenever we're talking about numbers in terms of how much we're giving in the scholarship, that is the purview of the legislature through appropriations, how much those particular categories of things are funded?
Yes. Certainly, like I just spoke about, so some programs like Bright Futures, like Benequisto, those are, we have revenue at, well, revenue estimating conferences, is, and that's enrollment. So you try to project the best you can through those estimating conferences how many students are going to be there. And so those are the state, you all, legislature, has to use those estimating enrollment numbers. For some of the other ones like you speak of, the need-based, those are set, so you would have to talk to your committee members about if you wanted to raise those.
Thank you very much. And Ranking Member Benjamin wanted to, that we have 18 different programs, and I'm, my door is always open if you want to sit down and discuss this and also a way to not only combine them, but make them easier to access for everyone.
And to that tune, just one last question.
Okay, you're recognized.
And that is, if we wanted to lower the requirements of, let's say, Bright Futures, my son took advantage of Bright Futures 4 years ago, and the top level, the, what is it, the...
FAS.
Mm-hmm. The SAT score was a 1290. Now my understanding is a 1330.
That's right.
If we wanted to bring those scores, what would it take for us to bring the scores down?
Change statute.
All right. Thank you for those questions, Ranking Member. Representative Maggard, you're recognized for a question.
Thank you, Chair. If you won't mind, I have a couple.
Absolutely. You're recognized for a series.
Thank you very much. Can we go to slide 13? I'm a little bit like a chair. I don't do gas, but I'm a simple businessman. So if you take Miami International University Art and Design, 27% of their students get a job when they walk out of that school. Is that correct? Is that how I'm reading that?
Yes, sir.
Okay. So when I look at all these percentages of employment, are these based... So my first assumption would be that Miami International's not teaching what the market's wanting, and that's why they can't get a job? Or... I mean, why is a school at 90 and the school's at 27%? Is it what they're, the people they're graduating, what they're teaching, the course curriculum, or what is that? Do you have an idea?
I do not. I don't think I would be the one to answer that question about why it would be low. I'm sorry, I can try to find that out.
That'd be great. Thank you.
I'd like to, because it makes a difference. You know, if you look at it from a business standpoint, well, that's not a very good return on investment. If we're doing all this, and at the end of the day, I'm getting 2.7 out of 10 people is getting a job. So there's a problem there, I would think, because either we're teaching a student's whatever they're graduating with, the jobs are not here for whatever they're teaching. And I'm not picking on Miami International. They're just the one that'd be 27%. Right. So I would like to know that.
Okay.
If you don't mind. Also, on St. Leo University, you alluded to this, the negative 425 affordability. So that means St. Leo's putting money in over and above and dropping the tuition rate for that student?
That, as an average.
Correct. So the average student's getting $425. Correct. The average student is getting $425 back in their pocket for whatever expenses they have.
Go to school there. I got one more, Chair.
Yes, sir.
Go to slide 6, please. I'll make sure I understand the math. So back in 2014 and 15, we had 128,545 student recipients for Bright Future, and we paid them $257.2 million, right? So in, what is that, 15, 7 years, we do 124,000 for $608 million. So what increased 57%? So that rate difference, 57%. So that means college, what it costs us to do college in 7 years has increased 57%.
Let me see.
Because we're doing less people over double the money. Just make sure I'm not missing that much.
I want to jump in here. At that point, it was not covering 100% of the tuition. It was a flat rate, and there were adjustments made.
Is that what?
Yeah.
So it's gone up, but it hasn't gone on that much.
Right.
Okay. That's correct. Thank you. That's all I needed to know. Thank you.
Thank you.
Representative Juan Porras, you're recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Suzanne, for that presentation. I'd like to get a little bit more clarity on the future rates and benchmarks that the chair was talking about, if we can bring up that slide again. Thank you, and I have a couple questions, Chair.
You're recognized for a
thank
series.
Thank you very much. So for the graduation rate, are these measured for a four-year graduation rate or for a six-year graduation rate?
Six.
Okay. And thank you. I'm aware we don't have anyone in ICUF in the room, but do you know how the ICUF institutions pair up in regards to the state university system in regards to these graduation rates?
I do not.
Okay. Final question. Just for clarity. And so for these state university system benchmarks, are they measured with four-year graduation rates or with six-year graduation rates?
I believe it's four.
Four? Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Cross, you're recognized.
Thank you, Chair. And I have a couple questions.
You're recognized for a series.
Thank you. My first question is related to whether you can combine some of these tuition assistance programs. For example, if a student has the Florida Medallion scholarship, so they're getting 75% of their tuition and select fees, but they also come from a need-based category, could they also layer on an FSAG scholarship with their Medallion scholarship?
Let's look at Parker, he's in the details, yes.
Okay, my other questions, thank you, are related to the EES. I think, you know, a lot of us are familiar with Bright Futures and some of these other ones, so appreciate you being able to share this and all of the information you provided to us. I'm just trying to understand a little bit how a student would access this, because it seems that the money goes to the student rather than to the institution.
No, it goes to the institution.
It goes to the institution.
Yes.
Okay. So if we're looking at increasing the benchmarks, I see for a lot of the categories that many of the schools, you know, are already over where you'd like them to be in a couple years or 5 years. If, say, for instance, University of Tampa, which is the closest one to my district, are looking pretty good on some of the graduation, retention, and employment, but maybe the access and affordability isn't where we would like it to be, would that prevent a student from being able to access those fees there, or would it mean that that institution would not receive that money from the state?
So this report was the department's recommendations, and that was required of us to submit those. So I just want to be clear, these are recommendations. Y'all can do what you feel is the right thing to do or the best thing to do, but I believe we would, if you didn't meet three of these benchmarks, then you wouldn't be eligible. The institution, we would not recommend them to be eligible.
Thank you.
All right, thank you. Representative Anderson, you're recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And thank you for your presentation. Thank you for the work that you're doing for our students, especially around Bright Futures. I think it's really one of the great programs that separates Florida from many other states. So thank you for that. I have two questions that are, I'm hoping you can comment around the ICUF program and the accountability and reporting in particular. You mentioned there's the five key performance metrics that these institutions are required to report on. It's my understanding that as the end of the last year, only 12 of them have completed that reporting, leaving 22 that have not. Is that accurate? And can you comment on why that might be?
I don't have that report right in front of me, so I'd hate to commit to anything specifically. There were quite a few that there were some that didn't report the data, and then we went back to them and get the data, if I'm not mistaken. So we had some back and forth there, but that was also the first year we were collecting data from them, so it was pretty new. Okay. But I will go back and look at that.
Do you have an idea of when that data can be expected?
The data from us from last year, this week.
Okay,
very good. Thank you. Very good.
And the second question,
mm-hmm. You recognize?
One of the other requirements is to post their, these programs, in an effort to increase transparency, accountability, promote consumer choice. Can you talk a little bit about why these ICUF institutions might not be following those rules? Why are they not making these? Why are they not posting these requirements?
That would not be me to answer that, unfortunately. So
hopefully we'll be able to have ICUF come back and answer some of those questions. Do you have any?
Thank you.
Do you have any further questions, Representative Griffiths? You're recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a couple of questions. If you
recognize for Siri.
Thank you for that presentation. It's very, and as I would echo Chair Schoaf, that it would be nice to have a dashboard of sorts for parents and guidance counselors and all to be able to look and find out their choices and what their future might lie. But on slide 14, why is the department recommending a 10% postgraduate employment and continuing education rate in year one? I know you mentioned these are just recommendations, so that's...
They are. They're recommendations, and that was our first year of collection of the data and really trying to pull it together. And that was, I believe, around the average.
I want to jump in with one question based off of what you just asked. Suzanne, what fiscal year are we talking about on this? Could you clarify... are we talking about school year or calendar year for 2022, 2023? Where would we be right now? I know that I've sat on this committee in the past, and we've been talking about this five-year scale for several years. I didn't know if we were on year three or still on year one.
I believe we're on year two. Right. We're in year one. And we're looking into year two for the 23-24 appropriation, right, for the purposes of where my mind is always.
Understood. I was under the impression that this chart came out several years ago and that everyone was aware of it, and we really were technically 3 years into this benchmark.
This would have been, I believe, the second year.
Okay. Thank you. And Rep. Griffiths, you're recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And so comparing the department's recommendations for this year compared to its recommendations from the last year, am I correct in saying that the five-year recommendation for the benchmark recommended last year, it's kind of the same glide path for year five? And I'd just like to get some understanding why the department is recommending such almost a status quo.
So when we first started this with pulling all of the rates, we had to figure out how were we going to move forward and to give time to the institutions to pull up their rates if needed. I mean, obviously some are doing better than others. So we felt that this was the best way to go at this point in time. Certainly, again, we wouldn't want an institution to just hit the bottom, just want to make it to the mark just to do that. We want them to exceed that, and our hopes are that they would, and we hope they do. But there were some that were low, and so again, we hope that they do exceed it. But as for the department choosing that, that was just the way that we thought would be a fair way to help to allow them to know this is the these are the rates, you're on notice, this is what's happening. So we're always, we can always reevaluate, and we certainly will, but it'll be just some time.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
All right. Rep. Rubman, you are recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and like everyone else, I also have a series of questions.
You are recognized for a series.
Thank you, sir. Ma'am, thank you for your presentation. It was very informative. And I actually want to talk about two of the subjects. The first one will be Bright Futures. If you could explain to us, is Bright Futures, is that an award that you earn and you get to keep for a certain number of years? For example, if a student were to, let's say, go to Georgetown or go to Harvard, and then want to transfer back to the University of Florida, because obviously that would be a better school. Do they get to keep their Bright Futures scholarship and use it even though they're a transfer from another university?
So I believe we do have a time limit, and I'm going to look to Parker, but there's a time frame.
That's correct. It's so long as the student did apply and receive their award letter, then they would have 5 years from graduation to use it. But again, they would have to have applied. If they miss that application, then there's no chance after the fact to submit a late application.
And ma'am, are we currently doing anything through Bright Futures? Let's say, for example, they go to the lesser school and they graduate, but now they want to come back to UF for a grad degree. Can Bright Futures be used towards a graduate studies program?
Students are eligible to use up to 15 hours of remaining Bright Futures hours. There's a total of 120 hours eligible for the program. So if they've got dual enrollment credits coming in, or let's see, I'd have to check on the going away, getting a graduate degree, and then coming back. But for traditional Florida students, if they've got remaining hours, they can use those in their first year of grad school.
Very good. And now I'd like to transition back to the EASE program. I know a lot of my colleagues, I think, feel the same way I do when we see some of these numbers. Again, I'm just a country doctor, but you know, math isn't my forte. But when I look at these 34 institutions that we have numbers on, by my math, there's at least 19 of them where a student that goes to these 19 colleges or universities, they're more likely to not graduate than to graduate. And so I was wondering if we have any kind of explanation as to why that's acceptable.
I'm not sure that I would term any low rate that moves any student just at a bottom level acceptable. And it certainly is an average, sometimes not a good average. And again, there are a couple of other rates that we're looking at for the future, because we can look at 5 rates, or we can look at 7 rates or 10 sets. But we also wanted, let me flip to my report here, additional information from these institutions. And so a future rate or a benchmark, that we would like to look at in the future is a wage attainment rate and a workforce-related degree production rate. And so the new wage rate, and again, I won't totally bore you with how to get that rate there, and we do have it in the report from the department. Those we thought were important rates to consider as well. We want them to continue to move. We want them to move up. We want these rates to go up. And unfortunately, we did have to start somewhere, and they're lower maybe than what everybody or some would like, but we do want to see success in every student in the state of Florida, and we want to give that a chance.
And to follow up on that, one thing that I wanted to point out, do we have an idea as to how much these students are paying? How much debt are they going into to go at one of these 19, you know, go to one of these 19 institutions with the low rates?
I don't have that information in front of me, so I'll have to report that back. Let me see if we can find it.
And Mr. Chairman, I think you can probably see where I'm going, because if I've got a son or if I have a daughter and they want to go to an underperforming college or university, and after going deeply into debt, if they're going to be right back where they started, you know, I think in the form of a question, is there more we could be doing in terms of holding these institutions accountable?
I think this is a good starting point. And again, we want to expand what we're looking at for rates, certainly as we're looking at the state of Florida being, you know, low unemployment rate. So we want to make sure our residents and the population in Florida gets the highest wages, you know, that they possibly can get. So that's what some of these new rates will also show us, is what else is happening. What, you know, and we want them to perform. Again, not all of them are not doing well. Some are, but I think you're asking about the ones that the rates are kind of low.
All right, thank you. Vice Chair Hawkins.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Not so much a question. I want to build off what the chair started with. I think we do need a condensed dashboard. Okay. But taking that, I work in this every day in my private sector job. I'm amazed at how many families don't think college is available for their students, especially our minority communities. Our Hispanic communities, they come in for their counseling and they are here about college debt, and they don't realize this money is available. So I think between, this is where silos of higher ed and that need to cross over and get that to the schools and find a way to make sure these parents are engaged, to know that these are eligible. But it starts, I think, with what the chair said, condensing this down. But I think we made a big step allowing the work hours.
Absolutely.
Last year to go. Absolutely. That solved a lot of my problems getting students involved, because many of these students, they're working to help support their families right now.
That's right.
So I think we do need to work between our high school counselors and higher ed, one, to condense what the chair was saying, but also how we educate the families to let them know their students are eligible.
Will do.
Very good. Representative Baker, you are recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I wanted to go back to the Bright Futures, the slide 6. I know how important Bright Futures is. I was a recipient of this program, and I see overall there's been a decrease in the students receiving Bright Futures. So my question is, can you discuss why that is? Is it merely because the state has increased the requirements to be able to receive the scholarship, or are there other reasons? And then, I'm sorry, there's kind of two in one. Could you give an overview of the history of how the requirements have changed, if you have that information?
I don't have that information, of which when you're talking, I was like, gosh, I wish I'd have brought that sheet with me. It laid out all the changes, of course, and it's at my office. But I will get that back to you. But there have been different requirements, shifted, changed. They're different over the years, and reasons are different from over the years. So, but I will provide that back, and that way you can see a timeline.
All right. Representative Franklin, you're recognized.
Thank you so much, Mr. Chair, and also I have a series of questions as well, if you don't mind. First, thanks for your leadership. Everything you do is all about access and affordability, and so that's so important for people like the Vice Chair mentioned that might not have the means, or their parents might not have the means to send to college. My first question is around the Florida Student Assistance Grant Program. I know there is an awards range, it seems like, that exists. And I was wondering, how is that calculated? Is that strictly based off of I have more need, I kind of get a higher amount? And the reason I asked that question, too, because I noticed that the average award was about $1,600 or $1,700. And so I was just kind of curious, in that need-based space, how do they calculate how much you would receive for that FSAG grant?
Yes, FSAG. So, right, both the maximum, I was looking at this year and last year, the maximum was $3,260 and the minimum was $200. Do you have right off the top of your head how that's calculated at those levels?
So each institution determines how many students they want to award that grant to, the minimum being $200 per student per award. So they may have, say, 1,000 students, but they only have enough funds for 800 of them, and each of those 800 have different needs based on, is that student working? Does that student have additional funding from parents, or what each situation looks like? So at the institution level, they determine how much the award is.
And sorry, and do they have an application process for that? They just look at eligibility and then just provide it, or is, do they apply for that at
all? They have an application process at the local level at the school.
And then that leads me to my next question, too. I looked at all the state financial aid programs, and I kind of had my attention to the different ones. I saw the Rep. Benjamin asked about Minority Teacher Education Scholars Program, and I was wondering, are there any applicants, and this is, I guess, all maybe 10 or 15 of these, do we have more applicants than we do funding in most of these, or is it other way around for any of them? So essentially, you know, is it more so, you know, do we have a lot of people that are applying and not getting these different grants, or do we have kind of a...
I don't believe there is a wait list on any of those. There, we hit the max on some, right? Yeah. I'm having a conversation.
No, it's fine. Yeah, y'all are.
It is program specific, FSAG being the biggest one that has a wait list or students who could qualify, but there's not enough funding. We call those otherwise eligible students. I believe there's a wait list on EASE, but for the most part, most of the programs are fully funded. The ones that do have caps, like ECOE and Rosewood, have a limit of 50, so there are situations where students may qualify, but I don't think, because those are so tightly restricted, I don't think we hit those caps.
Thank you so much.
One second. I just wanted to clarify. It's my understanding that there is no wait list on EASE. Maybe we can get back with you on that, or
yes,
you can get back to us on that. Go ahead.
And my last question was around the matching private funds for some of these aid programs. Does dollars out of a university's foundation kind of qualify for that when you say private matching funds, or does it have to come from a private company? I know the dollars in the foundation are typically private dollars, but I didn't know today.
It can be from any source. The institution is sending it in. So if it's you donating to your alma mater and they're sending that into the state, or if they're pulling it out of their foundation, they're sending those funds in to the department to match against public funds.
Thank you so much.
All right. Representative Cross, I believe you had another question. You're recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I know we're beating a dead horse with some of these performance benchmarks, but on page 14, I'm just trying to understand the difference between the fiscal year, the year one, the postgraduate employment or continuing education rate of 10% compared to the chart from September 2022 of the self-reported performance, because it looks like if we're seeking to have a 49% employment rate, that there's only a couple schools right now that are reporting something lower than that, which is, I think, five of them. So the majority of them out of these 34 institutions are already exceeding that amount. So I'm wondering where these lower numbers, the 10%, 20%, et cetera, came from.
If I remember correctly, we were trying to keep the formula the same all the way across, just to make sure that we didn't vary really a whole lot or make a mistake in any of these, the ways that we did them. So it was just maintaining a formula of the same all the way across for all of the rates. That was it, really.
Okay, thank you.
All good there. Ranking Member Benjamin, you're recognized for a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have three questions, and you may have to come back to me, so I'll just give them to you.
Okay.
What percentage of students receiving a need-based scholarship are attending a state university?
Okay.
What's the breakdown of the average FSAG award amount by sector?
Okay.
And I'm getting a sense of what the answer is to this next question, but the decrease in the EASE from $2,800 to $2,000 last year, do we know why that was necessary,
or why we decreased.
It was appropriated $2,000.
All right, thank you. And if possible, if you could,
yes,
you could get those,
I will certainly follow up with all of those.
Thank you very much. Rep. Anderson, you're recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. One final question. It's about the funding of these different programs. I think we counted approximately 18 was the number, give or take. And we know that you had mentioned the Bright Futures scholarship is funded by the Florida Lottery. Is that true for all of these 18 programs? Are they all funded with lottery funds? And if not, where are those funds coming from?
No, they're not all funded. excuse me. Bright Futures is the only lottery-funded program. And that's, I think you see the signs and all the flamingos and things like that. So you see that mostly. The other programs are funded by GR, General Revenue. I'm trying to think of what other funding sources that would go in there, but most are funded by General Revenue.
Thank you.
Funds.
Thank you very much. That concludes our questions from our members. We do have some public speaking forms. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Really
thank
appreciate
you.
It. I want to brag on Ms. Pridgen. She's really does an amazing job, and we threw a lot of questions at you. So, but I've
just
worked
throw
with
some
you.
Amazing answers back.
Yeah, no, worked with you for the last 3 years, and you really are first class. So thank you so much. All right, Mark Anderson, come on up. You are recognized, sir.
Good afternoon, Chairman and members. Good to be here. Mark Anderson representing South College in Orlando, Florida. I want to thank Ms. Pridgen as well for that information. That was enlightening, and I actually had not expected to speak today. And as I was reviewing through the presentation, I noticed on page 3, there was a very illustrative table that I think lays out the inconsistency. I'd love to just flag for your benefit today and hope we can address moving forward as we get into the legislative session, and it's relating to the EASE grant program, but it's also relating to the issue of access. I know we've talked a lot about metrics and very important information, but access is really what I wanted to focus on, Mr. Chairman. And with your indulgence, I'd like just to go back a brief history. I was part of a group of stakeholders some years ago when I was on staff, and there were efforts by this legislature at that time to create greater access for students across all sectors of higher education. Back in 2000, 2001, there were studies that were showing Florida was woefully underperforming in the delivery of baccalaureate degrees that were leading to employment for students to be able to get a job in Florida. Those were the type of jobs that paid well, that stayed here, but Florida wasn't producing a lot of those types of degrees. So in the public sector, the barrier to that was where you lived dictated whether or not you would be able to pursue a degree at a public institution. So the barrier the legislature identified at that point in time was, let's create more access points. So that was when the then community colleges were granted the opportunity to grant four-year degrees. And we had four-year degrees being granted now across all the state, across the state of Florida. Now we have Florida colleges with that authority giving access to students pursuing four-year degrees in our public universities. In our private sector of higher education that year, the barrier that was identified was affordability. Going to a private college, it costs more. And there's many more of them. So the issue was not geography, but was cost. How could a student better afford to go to a private college of choice, assuming it identified the needs that they were looking to address and they were able to go, but they weren't able to afford it? Where could they go? So the legislature found in that third category you had on page number 3 of that presentation, a category called tuition assistance. And what we identified at that time was in the need-based aid silo, in the merit-based aid silo, an award would be given to a student, the money would follow the student, full choice was granted. You could go to a public institution, you could go to a private institution, for-profit or nonprofit. As long as the money followed the student, as long as the student played by the rules, as long as the institution they chose to attend was accredited and played by the rules, they could go anywhere they wanted, except when you get to tuition assistance. In tuition assistance, there was only one grant program for which a student could qualify, and it was called at that time the Florida Resident Access Grant Program. It's now called the EASE Grant Program. That program was for only certain types of students attending certain types of private institutions. So the legislature looked at what could we do to increase access to that program for the students who did not, who could not or did not qualify for NEET, who did not or could not qualify for merit, but who still needed the help to go to college. You have a lot of students who, because they work, they can't qualify for need-based aid, so the income disqualifies them. You had students who, as we do now, didn't make good grades or did not attend a Florida institution, so they couldn't qualify for or receive merit-based aid. Where can they go? They still need help to go to school. So tuition assistance grants, the FRAG program, was the only place they could go. The legislature thought about, at that time, expanding what was at that time the FRAG program or creating an alternative. And that other alternative they opted to create was called the ABLE Grant Program. And for 20 years, the legislature in the state of Florida was able to say, and students across the state were able to have access to every school they chose to go to, no matter where they wanted to go to school, so long as they qualified. Unfortunately, a couple years ago, and I think unintentionally so, the legislature repealed that program. And there was an empty box under the EASE grant program under that table that had tuition grants that used to be filled with the words ABLE grants. And what has happened is now there has been a gap, I think, again, unintentionally created for students who, through no fault of their own, have chosen to go to a school that meets their needs, that's fully accredited, that's a good actor, that has metrics, in the case of my school, that are off the charts. In the case of my school, is responding to a critical nursing shortage in our state. But because of where they've chosen to go to college, they can't receive anything. They get zero from the state. These are students who can't qualify or don't qualify again for merit or for need, but because of where they've chosen to go to school, they can't get anything. So what we're asking, if you could, and if you would be so interested or so inclined, is to please take a look at expanding access to the only other grant program they could qualify for, which would be the EASE grant program. It requires a statutory change, or to provide some alternative that would enable them to continue their education. We have students now who, for a second year, South College has opened its doors now for 2 years, who are either faced with dropping out of school or encumbering themselves with more student debt, neither of which is a great option. And I know that's not the wish of our legislature either. So with that said, Mr. Chairman, I would just say I think that EASE is a great program. I heard a couple of comments on the record. I wanted just to further clarify. I heard it was said that it was for nonprofit and for-profit. It is not for for-profit students attending a for-profit. It's for a nonprofit, SACS accredited only, which is the barrier that's presented for many of these students. And the grant itself, Representative Cross, I heard you ask about the grant. It's intended to go directly to the student, not necessarily the institution. But if there's a way we can create that greater access, that would be great. EASE is a 44-year-old program. I'm not sure too many things that have stayed exactly the same for 44 years. EASE has. Meanwhile, the landscape of our higher education system has changed dramatically to reflect a more diverse type of student, attending a more diverse type of institution, pursuing more and different types of degrees. Meanwhile, the only program they can qualify for has stayed exactly the same for 44 years. If there's a way we can change that, we would love to work with you. And I'm representing a very small school, but our students need the help. They're doing exactly what they're supposed to be doing, and through no fault of their own, they have no access to these tuition grants that up until about a year ago they would have had access to. So we look forward to having that conversation, Chairman, and we appreciate the time.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Anderson. One second, if you have time for a question. I just wanted to make a comment, and then we have a question. I do believe that the students at South College will have access to Bright Futures and the FSAG grant awards. And also I wanted to clarify that ABLE was terminated intentionally.
Pardon me?
ABLE was terminated intentionally. It was not an accident.
Oh, no. I was just thinking the gap that was created, I think, was unintentional, Chairman, gotcha. Is what I meant to say. I think I know why it was created.
Ranking Member Benjamin, you're recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I mean, that conversation brought up the question, because I was thinking the same thing, that if it was done unintentionally, one, what's the difference between the able body and EASE, and then now you say that it was done intentionally. Why was it done intentionally? Why did we get rid of it if it gave the type of access that the gentleman is talking about?
Yeah, we would have to go back and look at the meetings we had in the last 2 years. And overall, though, They were very low performing, and it was determined by the committee at that time that it was not a good investment of public dollars.
And we were never, Chairman, if I could answer to it, we were never part of that program. South was is a new school, so they would have, but they never did, and were never in the ABLE grant program. I just flagged that because it was the only other program they could have qualified for had it been around.
All right. Thank you very much.
Yeah.
This concludes our committee agenda. Is there any further business before the committee? Seeing none. Thank you all again for your time. That was a lot of information and a lot of wonderful questions. I really appreciate you all engaging in the manner in which you have. So, seeing no other business, Representative Baker moves we rise. Without objection, the meeting is adjourned.